All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fucking ears? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going? Everybody okay? My heart goes out to the people in the Carolinas, and you know, I got friends down there. I got a gig down there in February. It's just awful to hear what's happened in Asheville and surrounding areas. It's just devastating. And in light of that, Brian Jones has created a new batch of black and gold cap mugs that he makes for me and my guests. And they go on sale starting tomorrow. And the only way you can get them is to be a guest on WTF or buy them from Brian Jones. But for this batch, Brian is using a portion of the proceeds to donate to relief programs in North Carolina. The western part of the state was just devastated by Hurricane Helene. And there are a lot of people who work in ceramics there. I know some of them. I've traveled to Seagrove. I don't know what's happened in Seagrove. I don't know how the big cats are at the Carolina Tiger Rescue. I don't know. But it just looks devastating. He'll be donating to Mountain Projects. That's a local agency specializing in reaching the lower income and underserved people in that area. He's also donating to CERF, C-E-R-F, the Craft Emergency Relief Fund. This is aid for artists to help get their studios back up and running, because that's their livelihood. So if you want, go get those cap mugs starting at noon Eastern tomorrow. That's October 4th at WTFmugs.co. You'll get a mug and you'll also help out. That's WTFmugs.co. Or you can look up Mountain Projects or Surf or whatever charitable institutions that you work with to try to help out down there. So heavy stuff. Heavy environmental catastrophe. But today I talked to Connie Chung. Yeah, that it just came up. She got a book out. You want to talk to Connie Chung? Yeah, I mean, I'm always curious to talk with broadcasters and journalists and interviewers. That's happening. You'll hear it. I will be at Largo tonight. That's Thursday, October 3rd here in Los Angeles. The rest of my tour dates are scheduled for next year. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to see all of them. But I do believe I have a date at Dynasty Typewriter, actually, also this month, like one other hour-long show, hour plus. October 26th, actually. I'll be in the middle of shooting that movie, but I figured, okay, it's a Saturday, let's do it. I had to go get a haircut and go do a wardrobe fitting for this movie. This movie is going to be nuts. I mean, we're starting to shoot October 14th, and he wants to do it in 20 days. That's a lot. And I've just been spending a lot of time trying to get into character or figure out where I'm coming from for this particular guy. He's kind of a self-centered guy. A little bit of an asshole. He's got a few months to live. It's going to be a stretch for me. It's really not, it's out of my wheelhouse, but, I accept the challenge to play a self-centered asshole. So look, good news for everybody. Although I don't really hear it right now, I'm getting some new mic booms. New mic booms for the studio, I think. I've reached out to Shure. Shure, that I've done nothing but celebrate the Shure SM7B, the microphones that we've used since day one. Industry standard. A lot of people get the cheaper podcast mics, but spend that extra money. Get yourself a Shure SM7B. They're making another one with a built-in preamp. And I was looking at him and I was like, do I need this? I talked to Brendan. He's like, well, you know, the ones we have are fine. They've always done us done good by us, but I'm going to try to get these mic booms ASAP. Yup. That wasn't even a paid plug. That just is what it is. Busy. Busy. I mean, I'm glad to be alive mostly. Yeah, I'm pretty healthy. I have a lot going on in my life, it seems. Very busy. So sometimes I just, I have to ask myself, why am I not thrilled? There's a lot going on in the world. A lot of bad stuff. But I just can't settle my mind about certain things that I should have let go of a long time ago. Why is that? I have a feeling it's just part of my engine. And I'm not sure how the engine will run if I take out those parts. And I don't even know if I can at this point. It's crazy. I guess I'm just talking to help. Is that possible? Resentment, self-judgment, fear, insecurity. Those are actually, that's like a menu of the three prime movers of almost any ism, whatever your ism is. And look, I'm highly aware of all of them. They don't run my life. Actually, most of them don't have too much real juice in my mind, but they're still reflexes. I have to deal with those things almost daily and in many ways. On many levels, they just gnaw at me as opposed to running my life, I think. I mean, is gnawing, but I don't look at gnawing as the same as running. Look, it's just weird. But when you have issues that gnaw at you but don't consume you because you are aware of them every time they come up, you have to engage with them and disarm them. That is the daily battle. And when you are victorious, it feels pretty fucking good for a few minutes or a day or an hour. And look, I guess I envy people that don't really have to fight that fight most of the time. But I think fighting it out, by doing that, I get some of my best thinking and inspiration done. Is that me committing to my mental illness? It's just, they're just fundamental parts of my thinking. And I think they're the roots of my empathy to some degree. Look, I guess what I'm saying is every day is full of exciting revelations when you take almost everything personally, when you project a lot, and when you imagine the worst outcome of most situations. Every day filled with surprises. But the truth is, look, they're all kind of tired. And the beautiful thing about getting older is you really start running out of fucks to give just from experience and wisdom. You're running out of fucks. The wisdom that comes from giving way too many fucks and realizing most of them are a total waste of fucks and a fucking waste of time, that's priceless wisdom. Hard-earned fucking lessons. It does seem that I'm missing out on some of the fun parts of life. The whole being alive experience. But look, to be honest with you, some room has been created from all the space that was being taken up by all the fucks I was giving, and I'm getting some real peace of mind, some real peace sometimes. Zero fucks equals peace of mind. As long as the fucks you are giving up are non-essential fucks, it's important to keep the essential fucks in place. Principles. Some of those principles can be rooted in fear and resentment, but why judge that part of the principles if they are solid? Most of the principles come out of some kind of empathy for the truly unique people of the world and the people in pain. I don't know. When your brain is spinning all the time, just trying to find a place to land in the chaos of your life and the world, and that's a problem to be solved like all of the time, you're at least 90% more interesting than well-grounded, confident people. That's what I think right now, today. And I'll question it as soon as I finish saying this. Right? Right? All right, you guys. Look, Connie Chung is here. Well, she was here. Her new book, Connie, A Memoir, is now available wherever you get your books. And this is me getting off to a, slightly rough start with Connie Chung. You got a lot going on, Connie.
You bet.
What's the event tonight?
You know, all of these are in conversation.
Yeah.
So,
and how's that usually go for you?
Fine. I prefer to just speak.
Yeah. Without being talked to.
Well, just rather, because I can control the flow.
Yeah.
And I know how to make a beginning, middle, and end.
Right. Like, as somebody who interviewed people, so when you have to do a moderated conversation,
mm-hmm.
do you just generally take it wherever you're going to take it, or do you, you know, engage?
Oh, I engage, but
yeah.
but because I used to interview politicians,
right.
I know how to not answer a specific question and go off in a direction that I want to go.
Isn't that kind of amazing how they do that?
No.
But I mean, but you learned the lesson from them. There's definitely a way to do it. You just take the question, acknowledge it, and then somehow weave into something else.
You got it.
Yeah. And does anybody pursue the question? They're not probably chasing down information.
No, I used to, but a lot of people are too. A lot of people won't.
Yeah, I didn't learn that until I think I interviewed Bill Clinton on the phone once, and I realized that he wasn't having any kind of conversation with me. I was asking questions, and it was almost he didn't hear me.
Are you recording?
Yeah.
When did you start?
Just a few minutes ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell me, you should have told me.
Well, this is the trick of the trade. You didn't say anything. No, I put you on right when I said, what are you doing tonight? And you said the conversation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing before that. I didn't record you eating a sandwich.
Oh, too bad.
That would have been inappropriate in your business to turn the mic on, right?
No, I wouldn't have minded.
Yeah.
As long as you don't mind my smacking my lips.
I don't mind. It's humanizing, Connie.
Of course it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I do eat and I'd go to the bathroom.
Yeah, I'd heard that, but now I know. Both of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you'd rather, when you speak, you just like to kind of lay it out, your whole story?
Yeah.
Not unlike the book.
Correct.
And you wrote the whole book.
I did write the whole book.
Nobody helped.
No, I had two editors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I submitted what is commonly called by people who have written books, the so-called shitty first draft.
Yes, of course.
And
And what surprised you about your first draft when an editor sent it back?
The fact that I was told I was providing simply facts. And I said, yeah, that's what I've done. That's what I do. And I said, yeah, so?
Yeah.
And the editor said, you need to tell how you feel.
Oh, yeah.
The feelings.
Yeah.
And so I thought, no.
Yeah.
Had I known that, I never would have embarked on this adventure.
You just want to do some honest reporting about
exactly.
yourself?
Yes. I saw nothing wrong with that. So that's what I was doing.
No humor, no color.
No.
Just
it was going to be
straight
a rollicking good time. It was going to be a humorous book. Did
it
you?
Was.
By the way, did you read it?
I've read parts of it.
Oh, you didn't read the whole thing.
Well, I mean, if I read the whole thing, then I'm going to lead you and I'm going to expect you to tell. Like, I find that if somebody can talk and they're here to talk about a book, it's better if we can have discovery as opposed to me knowing everything before.
No.
This is my process.
Well, it's not the right process, Mark.
What is the right process? To know everything? I just had a woman in here earlier whose book a musician. And I kind of knew her, and I read more than I should have, because then all of a sudden there's stories that aren't told, and some stories are told in a different way. You know, when you write a story, it's different than when you tell a story.
No.
That's my belief.
That's your belief?
Yes.
No, I'm accurate.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying you're not accurate, but in telling a story or having a human moment or having an exchange, it's different than presenting it in words. on the page.
No, you got to do your homework, Mark.
I did some homework.
Yeah, but like what?
What, you're going to question me about my homework? About like your childhood? Or about, well, you know, the stuff that really interested me because I'm 60 and my recollections of people that you were involved with, like, you know, Walter Cronkite and the politics of the time, are very young memories for me. And those guys that you worked with, like, you know, Roger Mudd and that whole crew, Walter Cronkite, and those guys were just these sort of like authoritative memories of mine that I don't really have a context in. So I was particularly interested in the feelings that you have about coming up with those men and also about politics at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you showed up in Washington to do that work, and your feelings about Walter Cronkite were what?
Like I said in the book.
Yeah.
As a family, we used to always watch Walter. We would sit down. It was appointment television.
How many people were in your family at that time?
No, the same number that were always around.
Yeah.
I have had my mother and my father and my four older sisters.
And you would all sit there and watch Walter.
Uh-huh. It was appointment television. We made a point of sitting down and watching Uncle Walter because he was the quintessential authority on what happened that day.
Yeah.
And because the ABC, NBC, and CBS, the three big networks, controlled basically the news and information that people received, because there was no cable, there was no social media, there were no other outlets. So we sat down and watched Walter.
And your dad was had lived in, I mean, he came out of, like, I know that he came out of China and he was involved with the government of Chiang Kai-shek, yeah?
Yeah.
And that...
And my mother, too.
Yeah.
They were born in 1909 and 1911, so they were born into pre-communist China.
And were they there for the turn to communism, or they got out earlier?
They got out earlier. My father was in the diplomatic service. He was actually a spy, a spook, working for Chiang Kai-shek. And he found all sorts of ingenious ways to get out of China.
Yeah.
It was during the Sino-Japanese War, and the Japanese troops were licking at their heels from Suzhou to Nanjing to... Do you remember the rape of Nanking?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they got out just in the nick of time, and they made their journey out of China and arrived in 1945.
And when you so your father, like, in terms of coming to America, in terms of knowing the politics of China, I mean, what was the shift for him? I can't imagine. Like, did you have conversations, long conversations, about what it was like to be a spy?
No, he was very he held everything close to the vest. He wrote what was the beginning of a memoir.
Yeah,
and I came upon it because I've always kept it. And he describes in great detail, which I use his information to describe their escape. They grew up very traditionally. My mother's feet were bound. They were engaged at 12 and 14, an arranged marriage. And then they were married at 17 and 19 and never saw each other until the day they were married.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
I would think so. They were they did not have a love marriage. And what happens in China is that the women go live with the males, their husband's family, live under his roof for the rest of their lives. And so she endured an unpleasant existence, frankly.
Yeah.
And they had 9 children in China, 5 of whom died as infants. And three of those five were boys. That was not a good thing for a Chinese family, because in China, boys are coveted and girls are considered worthless. So when they came to the United States in 1945, I was born in 1946. I'm 78. So what they experienced was not what Chinese people really want to experience. They want a son. But my father kind of gave me a mission. He wrote me a letter, and because he liked writing letters.
Yeah.
And he basically said, maybe you can carry on the name Cheng the way sons do.
Yeah.
Carry on the family name.
Right.
Like Marin.
Yeah.
And I took that very seriously, being into filial piety. I took it seriously and thought, well, maybe I would be the son that my parents never had.
That's a lot of pressure, right?
Well, I didn't do it consciously, but I was dutifully going about my business as if I were a son.
And because of when you have parents that you say was at least initially a loveless marriage, in terms of the emotional tone of the household, what was that like?
Well, they were both working very hard. My father worked at two jobs to make enough money for to raise five daughters. And my mother, who both of them lived in privileged circumstances in China. My father's father was a jeweler, and my mother's father was the owner of a paper factory, which
yeah.
was a very useful commodity.
Yeah.
So they both grew up in the Shanghai area, in smaller towns outside of Shanghai. And what they did was they had servants and cooks and
yeah.
maids and nannies and all of that. So they lived a very privileged life. When they came to the United States, that completely was altered.
Yeah.
And my mother had to, she had to cook and clean, and it was a life that she had not been raised to do.
Oh, my God. It sounds like she must have been a little miserable.
She was.
Yeah.
She was indeed. I could hear her when she was especially annoyed.
Yeah.
She would chop very loudly with a cleaver.
And that's how you knew how to stay out of the kitchen?
You got it. And I forever stayed out of the kitchen for numerous reasons, not the least of which was being unable to recreate her meals.
Yeah.
But I eventually, thought better of it because her Chinese food is extraordinary. So I can now do that. But,
you can?
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
What, you want me to come over some Sunday and cook Chinese food?
Absolutely.
Not doing it. Don't even think about it.
Oh, you're teasing me. All right.
You bet.
But you did learn eventually from her?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a meal like you've never had in your life.
Yeah.
I mean, going to getting carry out on Sunday is nothing like it.
Yeah.
And getting Chinese food on Christmas Day,
nothing like that.
No.
I was in China briefly, but I don't think I had great food, to be honest with you.
Well, it's different.
Yeah.
It just is.
Yeah.
In China, you mean current China.
Yeah.
Republic of China.
Yeah, I was in Beijing, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Shanghai. But I went to—
How long ago was that?
It was right around the time— you remember when that spy plane crashed there? So it must have been like, maybe 2000, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd gone there to do a couple of shows. There was a guy who booked a couple of rooms for expatriates, and one was in Beijing and one was in Shanghai. And I'd never experienced anything like it.
Mm.
Because it's almost like another planet.
Yeah.
It was mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it was, I went to the Forbidden Palace. I went to the Great Wall. I tried to do some stuff. But it was I didn't know much about the culture and, you know, and, or the hutongs and that whole.
You weren't doing your homework again, Mark.
No, I was experiencing life, Connie. I was going out there and I was seeing the things that I had time to see and learning as I went along. I've done all right with it.
Mazel tov.
Thank you very much. You know, sometimes a little charm and curiosity will get you a long way.
Sure. But you can do that and do homework.
I did homework. I did enough homework.
Do you remember what Nixon said when he came to the Great Wall and visited China?
I knew from reading your book.
There you go.
Yeah.
That was one of the passages you did read.
Yes. He said this wall is a great wall or something like that.
Yeah. It's a great wall.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about that part of the book was that how it changed your parents or at least your father's relationship with China and his ability to at least see what was left of, I guess, his family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They could not get their citizenship and still write to the family in China. And so they had to cut off all communication. And it wasn't until Nixon opened the doors of China that they were able to resume writing letters.
Yeah.
And that's when they discovered that who was alive and who was dead.
And they were killed?
You know what? My parents actually never told me. I didn't put anything in the book because they didn't share that with my sisters and me.
But they knew.
They do. They did know.
And you didn't want to push it.
Well, you know, when my parents didn't want to talk about things they didn't want to talk about.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know. They just didn't want to share certain information.
And have you in your adult life ever explored that lineage? I mean, it seems like it's possible now.
Actually, I know. My father, I had gone back to China for both CBS and NBC, and I do know who is alive and who is dead, and I even interviewed someone who was a relative.
For TV?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And how did that go for you?
It was, everything in the People's Republic is controlled.
Yeah.
So I don't know that person, this cousin,
right,
was talking freely.
Sure.
So it was not a seminal moment for me.
Yeah.
Because I don't think they were able to really share information.
It's scary.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is. There is.
Because you knew you must have been on their radar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So that you were actually possibly endangering your cousin.
Well, they handpicked who I would speak with.
Right.
With whom I would speak. And that made them in control.
Yeah.
And this cousin was clearly able to deliver properly.
Yeah.
He didn't get in trouble.
So he towed the line and he's safe.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not wearing my glasses. Who's the guy with the guitar?
Chuck Berry.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
The best.
Yeah, of course.
The best.
Yeah.
And the Rolling Stones.
And the Rolling Stones. And mm-hmm. then I think I got behind there, I think there's a picture of Howling Wolf.
Who?
Howling Wolf.
Howling Wolf.
The blues man.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Gotcha. That's great. Chuck Berry was amazing.
Did you ever interview him?
No.
Yeah.
Mm-mm.
He was something.
He was. The best.
Yeah.
Really the best.
So in this family where, you know, you've taken the mantle of being the son your father didn't have.
Or my mother.
Or your mother.
Mm-hmm. Don't be piggy.
But, what you know, outside of you know, thinking of yourself in that way, yeah, how did they adapt to the idea of America? What did they feel like that needed to happen? Because when I talk to children of immigrants, there's a lot
they
of...
They weren't really, quote-unquote, immigrants.
Right.
They came over on official business. So they didn't arrive at Ellis Island. They actually arrived in... Where you were born, in Jersey City.
Jersey City, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So your father, in his capacity of a spy. Was there any inkling at that time that the communist takeover was coming?
Well, he had inside information.
Yeah.
And that's the intriguing part of his story. Since he had inside information, he could tell that the United States was quite torn as to whether or not they should support Chiang Kai-shek or Mao Zedong. And my father, because he worked in intelligence, was able to say to himself, I'm getting out of Dodge.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to wait around for the U.S. and for Chiang Kai-shek and Mao to either come to some agreement. It was, I'm getting out.
Yeah. Life or death, in a way.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. It was a life or death situation. So that's how they got my father. But basically what he did was he was working in the passport office.
Yeah.
And what he decided he would do was to find a way to come to the United States on official business. He commissioned himself to be a captain, I believe, in the I can't remember right now the exact rank.
Yeah.
In the Chinese Army. I mean, yeah. Chinese Air Force.
Yeah.
To train Chinese train Chinese cadets.
Yeah.
How to fly.
Right. That was what he said he was going to do.
Yes.
Right.
But Mark,
yeah.
He didn't know how to fly.
Of course. Right.
he became the administrator. And as it turned out, he came to the United States first because the ship that he was coming on refused to bring the family. So my mother had to stay in Bombay, which is now Mumbai.
Yeah.
And wait until she got a Western Union telegram and a American Express tickets for her and my four sisters. She discovered that she was pregnant. She also discovered, now this is a woman who did not speak any other language but Chinese, had never been out of the country, let alone, on her own.
Yeah.
But here she's got four little girls, and she's staying in a hotel. There are other people who are going to be repatriated out of China. I mean, who ended up in
India.
Bombay, Mumbai, India. So she discovers that she's pregnant.
With you?
No.
No.
Number nine.
Okay.
And so she tells my sisters, I'm going to take the oldest sister with me, and number two, you take care of number three and number four, and I'll be back. I don't know when I'll be back, but I'll be back. When she came back, she didn't have a baby anymore. Mm. And I've always asked my sister, what happened? Did she have a miscarriage or did she have an abortion? And I have this one, my second oldest sister, finally gave me the information when I was writing the book. I said, you have to tell me. And she's like a yenta.
Yeah.
She can't say certain untoward words. Like she'd say, they're getting a divorce, or he has cancer.
Right.
So she said to me, we're sitting in the kitchen, just the two of us.
Yeah.
And she said, she had an abortion.
Hmm.
So here my mother made this decision all on her own. We don't know how she arranged it, how she accomplished it, or what any of the circumstances were. But she came back, and I forgot to tell you that the reason why she did it was because if she had a baby, my mother and my four older sisters could not board a ship.
Right.
Because they were not allowing anyone younger than two.
Wow.
So
she did it for to keep the family together and to make the journey.
And to raise us in the United States.
The weight of that stuff. And you're growing up in it. You're born in, you can't, register any of this, probably some of these stories until you're now. But you're growing up in the weight of that. Those choices of your parents.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I can guarantee you that there are a million of those stories.
Sure.
And were your parents originally from?
My parents are all from here. My grandmother on my mother's side was born in Poland. Mm. They they're all Jews, and they all got out before Hitler. Mm. My dad's side of the family came from Belarus, and there was Poland, Belarus, mm-hmm. Ukraine, mm-hmm. but they all came up here. There was nobody, you know, that made it under the wire or lost in the mm-hmm. Holocaust.
That's so fortunate. Yeah. Ashkenazi.
Yes. Uh-huh. Full Ashkenaz. I did the 23andMe. I was hoping for a little Viking, but no, I got 99.9% Ashkenazi.
Are your parents still with us?
Yes. Yes. My dad's about halfway with us. But my mom's kind of fully with us for the most part.
Women are like that, aren't they?
Yeah. Physically, she's not doing great, but mentally, she's okay.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, sure.
That's great.
So, but getting back to the original question, so you weren't brought up with that kind of need to put a specific type of ambition that meant success in America that a lot of first-generation people have?
Well, I grew up very, very Chinese, but very Americanized.
Yes.
In other words, as much as we were listening to, you may remember, because you're 60, you may remember like Frank Sinatra and Doris Day.
Yeah.
But we also went to see Chinese opera.
Yeah.
We ate Chinese food that my mother cooked at home. But we also had a neighbor who taught my oldest sister how to make roast beef, lemon meringue pie, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, hot dogs, you know, spaghetti.
And this was in the D.C. area.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you had Chinese opera. You had culture that would play to, you know, to your family.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so my parents instilled in me and all of the sisters this very Chinese tradition.
Yeah.
And we were proud of being Chinese. At the same time, we were proud of how Americanized we were becoming.
Yeah.
And
so only Chinese spoken in the house mostly?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you had to learn English from the ground up?
I actually, because I was born in the United States, I learned English and Chinese simultaneously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How's your Chinese now? Good?
A little dicey.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody I can practice with.
Yeah, but you can understand.
Definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I can't read and write it because I never went to school for it.
Yeah, yeah.
you know, when I went to school, it was all English.
How'd you choose a career path? Was it always going to be journalism?
No. I didn't know really what I wanted to do. I actually majored in biology and then switched to the business administration.
Yeah.
And I tried accounting, and I just couldn't figure out what to do. But then I worked one summer for a congressman on Capitol Hill as an intern. He was from New York. He was a former newspaper man. He got me interested in writing.
Yeah.
And I had to write press releases. But what I really eyeballed was what the reporters were doing. And since I grew up in Washington, I grew up on the Washington Post and the Evening Star and Walter Cronkite, my father was a news junkie. So and a history buff and a political buff.
Yeah.
So I grew up on that and realized that when I was on the Hill as an intern, that the pulse beat of government was right there.
And it was exciting to you.
Very.
Yeah. And you understood the way the government worked.
Yes.
And that was engaging.
There was no doubt that every reporter should cover Capitol Hill. because they have these arcane rules and and just simple things like the Robert's Rules of Order and how bills are passed and what the process is. If reporters don't cover Capitol Hill, they don't really have a sense of how the government ticks. And I found that to be an incredible experience, really good experience.
Like I imagine to learn government in that way, as opposed from a textbook, and to see it in action, and to see the process and how sometimes, how long it can take, maybe even years, to get something through. You know, it must have been, there's no shortage of stuff to learn, that's for sure.
It was intoxicating.
Yeah. And you're dealing with these politicians every day.
Oh, my God, yes.
And but it's interesting because I, at that time, because I can't imagine how somebody like you looks at what's happening now in relation to American government. I mean, it has to, like, I'm assuming that there was no way for you to predict what's happening now.
Oh, good heavens, no.
And that, you know, but, what—
journalists are not prognosticators.
Well, I know, but I mean, just even to spend that much time in Washington and to believe in the norms that kept it together and that there were at least, I would imagine, a few people that believed in service and, and in the nature of government.
Yes.
That the way that has been turned inside out has got to be, you know, I don't know if it's terrifying, but I you must be cynical.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, it's criminal. It's downright wrong.
Well, right, but I mean, but like there it was like this evolution of, you know, the first Trump administration. I mean, you were there, you know, when Nixon went down. So, and to look at why he went down and how it all transpired, and you could never even see that happening in government today. There would be no success in taking down a president anymore.
I'd like to believe there, it's still possible.
Yeah. Because I have to imagine that when you were there and Watergate was happening, that it was the most, like, earth-shattering thing to ever happen.
Best story I ever covered.
Right. And so, but leading up to that, you do talk about, you know, being around these men and being given opportunity. And you do pay some gratitude to Lyndon Johnson's legislation that enabled you and several other women to get these jobs.
Yes.
And who were those other women?
At CBS.
Yeah.
Well, let me roll back the videotape a little bit, okay? My sister-in-law, whose name is Lynn Povich, was working for Newsweek in the late 60s and early 70s. And she... women at Newsweek were only hired as researchers.
Yeah.
They could never be hired as writers, reporters, editors, nothing but researchers.
Right.
They were pigeonholed. So they met in the ladies' room, the only place where they could get some privacy.
Yeah.
And they decided that they would file a class action lawsuit. And because the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission was formed.
Yeah.
And they won.
Yeah.
That signaled to other corporations that
this was happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
And fair warning, the consciousness of all these corporations had already escalated because the women's movement and black movement were making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
So CBS News, which was the Tiffany Network, the creme de la creme, the Washington bureau chief, a man named Bill Small, decided that he was going to take preemptive action. And what he did was he hired four women in one fell swoop. One was black, Michelle Clark, me, Chinese, Leslie Stahl, a nice Jewish girl with blonde hair, and Sylvia Chase, a shiksa with blonde hair.
Yeah.
So, boom, every permutation and combination.
And he covered himself.
Yep. And he, but he also believed in us, particularly Leslie and me. Michelle worked in the Chicago Bureau and Sylvia worked in the New York Bureau. So he pushed us.
Yeah.
And he gave us opportunities. So he was a...
What were your first jobs? Just writing copy, doing reporting?
Reporting.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was a reporter. And back in those days, we covered the Hill, the State Department, the White House, the Pentagon, all the a general assignment reporter.
So you're just running around?
Yeah. Running up and down those marble staircases.
Yeah.
And chasing after stories.
Yeah.
And very often keeping the seat warm for a male.
Yeah.
Who is having lunch or whatever.
Just like taking notes and waiting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or attending the White House briefing or the State Department briefing or the Pentagon briefing and then filling in the Bigfoot, as we called it.
The reporter, the male reporter that would just come in and go, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm. Or like what happened?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Or who got up late and didn't make it or whatever. So they would show up and say, "What? Tell me what's going on."
Did anger, were you angry?
Only when I thought I should have done the story. And it happened to Leslie, too. Leslie,
early on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because we were the kids.
Yeah.
And so we did what we were supposed to do.
Just the two of you.
Uh-huh.
In a world of men.
Uh-huh. There were everybody in the newsroom was a male. Except actually, there was one woman named Mariah McLaughlin, and she did mostly radio.
Yeah.
And then Leslie and me. And as I looked around, usually my competitors were also white men.
Yeah.
And always the people I was interviewing on the Hill and at the White House, you can well imagine 1970s, it was predominantly men.
Yeah.
And white men.
Yeah. But at that time, you know, hold on.
Not that there's anything wrong with being a white male.
Thank God. Because I've been one my whole life. Hold on a minute. Yeah. I'm going to just shut that bathroom door.
Okay.
Because I get a little echo sometimes and it annoys me.
Okay.
You can't really hear it, but I hear it. But you're pretty diplomatic in the book about the nature of those environments in terms of what in current day would be, you know, either toxic or dubious.
Oh, it was toxic and dubious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But your choices were different then. I mean, you know, if you were to stand up in a different way or to make issue, you would just be out of a job.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was very, I acquiesced because I knew I was new and green and needed to just not say no, no matter how repulsive the assignment was.
But it's interesting, in my mind, the people that you were dealing with are mythic. You know, you dealt with Paley, the head of CBS. You were
The founder.
I mean, and he was one of the inventors of television.
Yes.
And these are, like, now, like, you don't hear their names very often. And at the time you were coming up, it was still pretty close to the source of this business evolving and becoming what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did they exude a power? Were they impressive people?
Well, I've covered presidents and world leaders and heads of companies. When you see them up close, you can see they have pimples and blemishes.
Sure,
and
they're people. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I interviewed Obama in my old garage.
I know that.
Yeah.
How did you get him to schlep to Glenville?
He went to Highland Park. It's even smaller.
It's even. Hollywood Park?
No, Highland Park.
Oh, Highland Park. Yeah. I know Highland Park.
Sure. Yeah, he came over there.
How the heck?
I don't know how it happened, but
who,
like—
Do you book your own interviews?
Sure. My producer booked it. They had reached out. It was his last, the last year of his second term. Mm-hmm. And
you didn't reach out to me.
Well, somebody did reach out to you. You were, you know, we knew you had the book.
Oh, yeah.
And then we were told that you were talking about yourself in the book, and my producer said, do you want to talk to Connie Chung? I said, yes, but I don't want her to yell at me or tell me I don't do my job properly. But I'll
am I doing that?
No, just a little.
Yeah.
But it's going
well.
I'm
just giving you a little, you know, stuff.
But I know, you know, I like it. I did realize that when I talked to Obama, because I was not— I'm dubious of politicians,
mm-hmm.
as anybody should be.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, my sense of him, like, I people become human to me very quickly, you know, right when they sit down. And he was very, you know, candid and seemingly, you know, open.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to believe he's really like that, but I don't know.
Yeah. No, you never.
Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know what it must have been like for you to be talking, to be dealing with Nixon, Rockefeller, all those mm-hmm. senators that, you know, Kennedy, any of them,
mm-hmm.
that, because once we learn about their humanity or their humanness, it's usually because they've screwed up somehow.
Mm.
But I imagine in talking to them, you learned a way around it, and you weren't necessarily looking for humanness, you were looking for information.
Yes.
So it was different.
Correct.
So when did you realize that, you know, you were on the right path in terms of, like, you know, I'm going to— like when you started to get camera time and you started to deliver the news, you know, as a broadcaster.
I was a broadcaster from the get-go when yeah. I was at CBS News.
Yeah.
And I was on the first week I covered a story, the first Friday.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
What story was it?
It was a story about an environmentally—
Oh, the phosphate story.
No, not phosphates.
It was unsafe,
environmentally unsafe detergent
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly it's just left me.
It's all right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, seriously, because I left my memory on I-95.
Yeah.
If you are driving on I-95 and you fry my memory, will you send it right
sure,
back to me?
Sure.
Thank you.
That's all the way back on the East Coast, so you haven't had it for a while, huh?
Yeah.
You left it on the I-10, I might be able to send somebody out to find
right.
it. Yeah, I-95 would be a long job.
Right. Oh, I haven't driven on a 10 in so long.
Right.
Thank goodness.
It's not the same.
No, I know it's
from
not
when
the
you
same.
Were here in, what, the 70s?
Yeah.
It's a lot different.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it was about the EPA trying to push through a detergent chemical that was environmentally unsafe. And
something like that.
Yeah, and you picked up something.
Well, what happened was an underling actually contradicted his boss.
Yeah.
And that was—
Oh, right. That's right. Yeah.
That's not— Cool.
And that's where you got on Cronkite's radar.
For the first time.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. that must have been just amazing.
Oh, thrill.
Yeah.
A thrill.
And you say he was a sweet man.
He was.
Yeah.
He was. I discovered that many men
yeah.
in the news business who became anchormen developed a disease called big shotitis.
Yeah.
And it's characterized by being unable to stop talking, engaging in self-aggrandizing behavior, unrelenting hubris,
yeah.
and my favorite, delusions of sexual prowess.
Uh-huh.
Walter was none of those things.
Yeah, yeah.
He was kind, he was nice,
yeah.
he was grounded, he was a good journalist, and he didn't take himself terribly seriously.
And he knew the job was communication and reporting
yes.
the news.
Yes.
I think it's very interesting because I would imagine a lot of the men that you worked with who were on the news for decades, for
yes.
my entire life,
mm-hmm.
were not geniuses.
No.
And they were not—
It's television.
But they weren't intellectuals even.
No.
They were just delivering the news.
Yes.
And I imagine so many of them got pretty far away from doing actual reporting at a certain point.
Absolutely.
And they were using people like you to supply the information for them.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That would have driven me crazy.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
But you know, somehow or another, I think you pay, you say that you got a pretty tough skin and you were preemptive with the— in terms of these men, you know, diminishing you or minimizing you or saying things about you?
It was, yeah. But, you know, I was young and didn't really think about it. I'm just driven.
Right. Okay, there you go. So when do you get your first big break?
You mean when I was at CBS? Those early days in the 70s? I think it's when the bureau chief, Bill Small, the man who hired me, assigned me to cover Senator George McGovern, who was the presidential candidate in 1972 running against President Nixon for his reelection.
I remember that. My mom took me to a rally in New Mexico where we grew up to see McGovern. She
really?
Was a big McGovern person.
And you also lived in Alaska.
A couple years. My dad was in the Air Force.
How old were you?
Yeah, I was like 6, 7.
Oh, so do you remember it at all?
Sure, I remember some of it. I remember the skies. I remember a couple of people. But I don't remember, you know, they're childhood memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how old were you when when your mother took you to the
government? Well, it would have been the 72, leading up to the 72 election, right? So it would have been like right when we got to New Mexico, probably 71.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember she
was. And that means how old were you?
Well, I was like, 63, so I was like 9. Eight.
Oh, so you do remember that.
I do. I do remember, like, I remember reading Mad Magazine. I remember, you know, some of the election. I remember her being excited about him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, but unfortunately, I mean, he lost big.
Yeah.
It was a landslide.
Yeah.
And but covering a presidential campaign was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was very exhilarating.
Because there's so many levels you have to operate on. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Do you think that maybe I was there in New Mexico? I may be very well have been.
Yeah, probably. And if you were following him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you were just a little tight.
Yeah. You were on the bus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you were.
On the bus.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But you didn't have a mustache and a beard.
No, you wouldn't recognize me.
I don't think so, yeah.
I was probably just wondering what I was doing there, and my mother was excited.
Did you have glasses? Did you wear glasses?
Not yet. Not until I was like 14.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, let me ask you something. Is that turquoise, the ring, was that from New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah?
These are all New Mexican rings. These two turquoise ones are New Mexican
rings. No kidding.
Yeah.
He's wearing three rings.
Yeah, this one's WTF. This was made by a fan.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a Zuni ring. From New Mexico. I think this one might be a Navajo ring that I bought recently. I go back, you know, my dad's still there, so I
nice.
So I go back, yeah. And I wanted to
very
have
nice.
A reminder.
Where did you get the title for your podcast?
You know, it was sort of a working title that just became the title. We didn't know what the show would be initially, and then it just stuck.
Mm.
So it was just out there. WTF is, you know, in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be a pretty good thing to ask. But it did, but Dan Rather also gave you a big shot, even despite the fact that you had problems with him later.
He gave me a big shot?
Well, he let you do that story in that moment where, you know, you showed up with the story that you were supposed to feed him, and he said, you do it.
You read that.
I did.
Good.
Yeah.
Let me give you a golf clap.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Connie. But I mean, but it's sort of, it must have been a very difficult kind of dynamic to have with these men who you needed to give you opportunity.
No, it was not incumbent upon another correspondent to give me opportunity.
Right.
But they could be either a little more generous than some of them were.
Yeah.
Or they could be
monsters.
Yeah. You actually typed out some questions.
Not really.
Oh.
Just information.
Oh, okay.
I don't work with questions.
Yeah.
I work with the hope of engagement.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So when you came out to LA, you saw that as a possible, maybe a demotion?
No, you know, I was offered the job. The general manager of the LA station.
CBS.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it was a CBS, what we called an owned and operated station.
And this is when you were doing the CBS morning show, right?
I was substituting on the CBS morning program, but I was still a general assignment reporter. But whenever I substituted on the CBS morning program, I felt like I was in the witness protection program because nobody watched the CBS morning program.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were all watching the Today Show.
Exactly.
Like my mother.
Yeah.
Because it was a broad-based news magazine entertainment show.
Well, it became your traditional morning chat show.
Yeah.
in which people drank their coffee and they watched Barbara Walters.
Yeah, yeah.
And she was the one that attracted viewers.
Did you know her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I knew her very well.
Yeah.
Although, you know, when you know Barbara Walters very well, there's still a cone around her.
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, you know, a lot of people, the number of people
with
you can't really get.
Public personality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You can't really get close, close, close.
Yeah.
So, Barbara, we were talking about the morning program, and do you remember where we were?
Yeah, taking the job in L.A.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I was doing my job.
Yeah, well, you're listening. Yes. And that is key to a good interview. Good job. I give you...
Another golf clap? I can't wait.
Okay. No, you get more. Okay. Ready?
Yeah. Oh, bigger clap. Good.
That's very good, because that's what you should do, always.
Yes.
Listen to what the person is saying,
sure.
And then go with a follow-up.
Right.
Excellent. Can I give you a fist bump, too?
Sure.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Watch that ring.
Yeah.
So
you took the gig.
I did. You know why?
Because you didn't want to be stuck on a show no one was watching.
But also because I was living at home.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How were you, like, late 20s?
29.
And you felt like you had to. You were responsible for your family.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're tired of it.
Well, it's just that I needed some separation.
Yes.
Because here I was, a rough, tough reporter.
Yeah.
You know, elbowing my way through news conferences and everything.
Yeah,
and here,
yeah.
And then I toddle on home to mommy and daddy's home.
Yeah.
It
didn't work.
No, I mean, I had to get out of Dodge. So I left.
But you were still able to support them. You were making more money. And
I was making more money, and that was the key.
Yeah.
The salary increase was unfathomable to me.
Yeah.
So I went off and thought, now I can, feel my freedom.
Yeah.
And
live in your own house, Hollywood.
Apartment.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It seemed like a pretty nice apartment.
It was. It was small, but it was nice. It
in
was
an old classic
Mondo
building.
Condo, yes.
Yeah.
How, you read that part.
Yeah, I did a little homework.
I'm very proud.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it was an exciting time to be in Hollywood. I mean, I imagine, were you a fun person, Connie?
Always.
Okay.
Always.
Were you out in the world? You're living right above Sunset Strip. You go into the Comedy Store. Are you doing stuff?
You know, I knew what they were doing, but I wasn't doing what they were doing.
Because you're focused on work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also, I was such a goody two-shoes that I was not dabbling in anything, you know, that they were dabbling
sure.
in. Sure. But if I may, did you know, Marc Maron, that I have a strain of weed named after me?
No, I didn't know that.
You did not know that.
No, I've been sober a long time. I'm not up to date on the weeds.
Okay.
How'd that happen?
I actually don't know. It's Connie Chung Weed,
mm-hmm.
and you can get it online.
Yeah.
I am described as easy to grow.
Uh-huh.
I have a nice fragrant smell. I create a beautiful flower.
Uh-huh.
And my personal favorite description is that I am low maintenance. Now, you know. And
is that true?
Well, who knows? Don't ask my husband.
Yeah.
I just saw online that you can get a pre-roll 5-pack for only $22. Is that good?
I don't know. You haven't tried it?
Well, you know, I don't do stuff. I mean, I did in college.
Uh-huh.
And
well, it's different now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. It's mm-hmm. much stronger,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And unlike Bill Clinton in college, I did inhale.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Had some fun.
Got to laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, but you know what else I found out just recently?
Yeah.
There's a drag queen named Connie Chung.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should meet them and get some pictures.
Yes. Yes.
Have you seen them?
No.
Oh.
Mm-mm.
Well, you're a very famous person.
Oh.
Yeah, everybody knows Connie Chung.
No.
Yes.
I don't think so.
So you had a good time in L.A. and mm-hmm. you became better at being an anchor?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I still wanted to burnish my career as a my reputation as a political reporter.
Okay.
So anytime a Clinton or I mean anytime a Carter or a Kennedy would come out to tap the deep pockets in Hollywood, I would interview them or request to interview them.
So the ambition to be like a national news anchor was not within you, or it just evolved?
I had a burning desire to climb the ladder.
Yeah.
But I didn't know. I would take it one step at a time, honestly.
Yeah. Covering national politics in Los Angeles can't be as engaging as being in D.C. or New York or anything else. So I'm assuming that you became more proficient at covering things that maybe didn't interest you as much, but getting some on-camera chops that would ultimately help you become a more broad anchor.
I think that's an accurate assumption, mm-hmm. and it was very much so. In fact, I covered – do you remember this group called Synanon?
Yes.
You do?
I do, because I read the Art Pepper autobiography, and there's a lot in there about Synanon, down Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
There was sort of like a cult, and they sort of – the mm-hmm. front was a drug rehabilitation, I think, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What about
did you,
it?
Did you read the whole book?
Yeah, I did. I read Art Pepper's whole book. I thought I was going to learn about jazz, but it was about – it was about 350 pages about heroin in jail and about 50 pages about jazz.
Are you a jazz enthusiast?
Well, I try to get into it, but it's a pretty big world, you know. But mm-hmm. I do like it, yeah.
Yeah, but what in particular? In other words, the instrumentalists or the jazz singers?
I'm not a big jazz singer guy. I do like the more adventurous instrumentalists. But Synanon, so what about that?
Well, I dug deep into Synanon, and I interviewed the creator, Charles Diederich.
Yeah.
And then he started to get off the track.
Yeah.
And
in what way?
Well, he and his cohorts began doing some rather peculiar things. There was a lawyer who won a lawsuit on behalf of a former Synanon devotee.
Yeah.
And the lawyer found a rattlesnake in his mailbox.
Okay.
So Diederich was threatening anyone who either filed a lawsuit or reported unflattering information.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought this all to light.
Yes. But also, I did a few interviews with
uh-huh.
him. And so
so that's exciting. That got you out of politics into something.
Bingo.
Yeah. Doing some reporting about something equally sort of relevant and mysterious and mm-hmm. impactful on mm-hmm. a community level, on a mm-hmm. cult level.
Mm-hmm. And it got me off the anchor desk because I think, anchor people who do just come in, read the news and go home are basically kind of lazy.
Well, but I imagine now that's not that's probably commonplace.
No, I don't know.
You don't know.
No, I'm not going there.
Right, but I mean, being an anchor on some level in a lot of quote unquote news programs is just an entertainment job.
Well, I don't think I can say that in a wholesale way. There are plenty who
cut their teeth as reporters
And did before they arrived on the set.
Yeah. So when do you meet Maury?
I met Maury, actually. You know Maury?
Nope. Never met him.
Okay. No. I mean,
I might have met him once at
really?
A thing. Yeah.
And what was it? Do you remember?
I don't remember. It must have been in New York, though.
Mm.
I know Maury.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Not unlike Connie Chung. Maury Povich is a household name.
Did you
he
live
invented
in?
Invented a thing, I think.
Yes. the paternity of discovering the paternity of every child in America. And he coined the phrases, you are the father, and you are not the father.
Are you saying this proudly, or just are you just giving me information?
Well, I'm providing anyone out there who does not have Maury memes with some information.
Okay, good.
But there you go.
You knew him a long time before you guys got married or started.
Oh, yeah. We dated for 7 long years.
Yeah.
And we lived in 2 different cities, which was perfect.
Yeah.
Have you ever been married?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You didn't do your homework?
No.
I've been married. You knew about Alaska, but you didn't know I'd been married twice.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't get to everything, okay. But I'm not interviewing you.
I know.
I mean, I did my part just to
have
just
social points to.
No, just not to be completely in the dark.
Oh, that's nice. I appreciate that.
Well, you know, in other words, you're not just another interview. Yeah. Why are you sighing?
Nothing. It was not a real sigh.
Okay. It is not. I think it's rude not to find out about the person who is interviewing, because you're not just another interviewer.
Yeah.
And someone else is not just another interviewer.
Right.
I feel that I should do my homework on you
a little bit. Yeah, I've been married twice. Yeah, okay. And you know, the distance helped you because you were probably both busy.
Yes.
And you didn't want to lose yourself in the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, well... No, it's just because you have your life and I have mine.
Okay.
You work, I work.
Yeah.
And then when we join each other, it's a rockin' good time.
So I guess when did you get married?
1984.
Oh. So he was with you through a big arc.
Yes.
Of what you went through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
and very supportive, I may add.
That's nice.
Oh, yeah. He's
still married. He must be a good guy.
Oh, he is.
Yeah.
If I may.
Yeah.
He's really a great guy. He's been my foundation, my go-to.
Look, anybody you convert to Judaism for.
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
Oh, well,
long ago.
Well, that's bad information.
Yeah. But don't ever go to Wikipedia, okay? No, seriously.
I know.
You know better than that.
I know.
I know you know better
I really
than
wanted
that.
You to have converted to Judaism.
Well... You know, I was very busy.
Yeah.
And my husband and his parents didn't
care?
No, they cared, but they didn't require it of me.
Oh, good. Well, that's good. Is he religious?
Oh, sure. We do the high holidays. Do you do the high holidays?
I used to. I sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Not always. And I try to think somberly on Yom Kippur, but I generally eat.
You too. You never fast. Or
I
used
to
fast.
Sure. I was born on Kol Nidre, so I think I get a pass.
Oh, you were born on Kol Nidre.
Yes.
That's very interesting.
I guess it's
possible.
Mystical.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the Jews in the world were repenting, and I was born. So I think I get a pass of some kind.
What a profound effect.
Kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
But we used to do Shabbat every Friday with our son.
Okay.
Because we raised him in the Jewish tradition.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Did he stick with it?
Pardon me?
Did he stick with it?
No.
Okay. You tried.
But he considers himself to be Jewish. It's just that, you know, it's very hard to keep up with tradition.
Sure, of course. Yeah. So
I mean, you fell away.
Yeah, but I think I'm kind of dug in some other way. Yeah, I do not do the ritual or the traditions. I was bar mitzvahed. I was brought up conservative Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, you were.
But because I don't have a family, I don't have children. I'm not around Jewish ritual that much. I don't have a synagogue. And at some point I decided, okay. You know, if somebody asked me to go to temple with them on the high holidays, I would. If someone invited me to a Seder, I would go.
Mm-hmm.
I would go to a Shabbat dinner. I'm just not in the loop. And like you said before we went on the mics, I'm not a hermit, but I don't socialize regularly with a group of people, which I think is required to find yourself in those situations.
Mm.
You know, understood. And if you have children, then, you know, that becomes another reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understood.
Yeah. So when you got the gig to be the anchor of the national news.
You mean co-anchoring on the CBS Evening News?
Exactly. Was that, how did you feel about that?
Dream job.
Yeah.
Absolute dream job, sitting in half of Walter Cronkite's chair.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
It was way too good.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just mighty proud.
What happened with that?
It tanked after 2 years.
How did it tank? Who was the leading news? That was it, Brokaw?
No, it was Peter Jennings.
Oh, Jennings, right? Yeah, yeah. Who you knew from back in the day?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh huh. And he was the quintessential anchorman as well.
How does that affect you? The idea that it tanked. I mean, do you? How does that sit in your being? Do you feel responsible?
Oh, no.
Oh.
I mean, I think the concept of a co-anchor on a half-hour broadcast is flawed.
Yeah.
Because there are only, you know, with commercials. Mm-hmm. You have commercials.
No.
At the beginning,
but not during the interview.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
How long are they?
Sometimes they're 30-second pre-show spots, and I think there's some 90-second spots, you know, before the interview. But nothing during the interview will pop up.
I see.
Yeah, and I do live reads, and we kind of put them in later.
You do what?
Live read. Like, I don't have just sort of like, hey, get a Toyota. You know, like, I do all the ads.
You do?
Yes.
And you don't have a problem with that?
With what?
Doing the live reads?
No, I'd rather do them than just drop stuff that doesn't have my voice on it into a show.
But is it for a product?
Sure. We decide. Mm-hmm. We have complete autonomy.
Discretion.
Sure. Uh-huh. You know, we vet things. We're not here. You know, we try to do the right thing.
Not like
as much as possible.
Medicine for old people.
No, not that. Occasionally, maybe we've done one vitamin ad.
Okay.
But no medicine. Mm-hmm. Nothing too dubious.
Okay. So anyway.
Anyway, so after the news, like, what happened with you and Dan? I know you talk about it a bit in the book, but it didn't seem good.
No, it was not good. It was bad. It was the end of the relationship.
Yeah.
It was kaput. It was over.
Yeah. But did that was that happening while you were on the air?
What?
The tension?
Well, I think I could feel a lack of comfort.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I mean, it was pretty darn obvious to me.
Yeah.
You know, it was there was a chill in the house, and it wasn't the air conditioning.
I like this character. I like that when you talk about Dan Rather, you go into a whole different character. Just so you don't have to experience the emotions as Connie Chung, the German character.
Is there something wrong with that?
No, I like it. I didn't anticipate that. This is that surprise I'm talking about. I didn't know I'd be talking to a fully formed voice actor talking about Dan Rather.
Well, I can do another one.
Oh good.
Yeah. But of course.
Yeah, sure.
This is the one.
Stiff upper lip one.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I like how you chose English and German, two aggressively non-emotional, other than one type of emotion characters.
Yes. I went to the Millicent Busybody School of Journalism.
Yeah.
Do you know, Mark, that I have, I excelled in having a potty mouth.
Did you?
Yes.
When was that?
When I went to the Millicent Busybody School of Journalism. It's just outside of London. Mm-hmm. You've never been there?
Mm-mm.
You must go.
So did you ever cuss at Dan Rather?
Not really.
No.
But behind his back, I did. I was let loose with all sorts of untoward words.
Yeah. And that I imagine that tension lives on today.
Well, no, you've got to forgive and forget.
Oh, so you've done that?
Not really. You know, my husband,
yes,
Maury,
yeah,
was president of the New York chapter of the National Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was the organization was providing a giving down rather an award, some kind of some such.
Yeah.
And he said, you should present it to him. And I said, not a chance. And so he said, no, you must.
Really?
I mean, my spouse is a wonderful forgive and forget sort of person.
Oh, my. So you really rallied? He really was trying to get you to do?
Oh, which, you know, just because.
Publicly, it would be a good.
No. It's because, you know, I think it was Nixon who said something about it only hurts you to hold a grudge of some sort.
That was Nixon?
I know. Isn't that extraordinary? So what I did was I did present him with the award. And afterwards, he picked me up off the ground and hugged me. And all I could think of was, put me down. You know, my legs were dangling like Edith Ann.
Yeah.
You remember Edith Ann, Lily Tomlin's
character. Right, off the rocking chair.
Thank you. So, and then, I saw him again on a train from New York to Washington, and he said, let's talk. And I said, oh, God. And we sat down at a table in an Amtrak train.
Yeah.
And he said, no hard feelings. And I said, okay.
I was hoping for a go fuck yourself.
No. I can't. No, not on WTF, Mark.
Yeah.
With Mark Maron.
Yeah.
So those are my close encounters of a Dan kind.
That was it.
Yes.
Yeah. But you went on. You did the interview shows, and you kept busy.
Not so much. I rose from the dead with this book.
It's been a while. I think, some people I worked with were involved with Weekends with Maury and Connie.
Oh.
Larson, Jonathan Larson.
You know Jonathan Larson?
He was with me at Air America. That's where I started on radio, at Air America. Jonathan Larson. Was Winstead involved too?
Yeah, Liz.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they were both. I've known Liz forever as a comic, going all the way back to the 80s.
Right. There you go.
How was that show? What happened with that one?
It was awful.
Was it okay working with your husband, though?
No. I mean, sort of. But, I mean, he's a quick study.
Yeah.
And he can, you know, walk into any situation and just not only wax poetic, but just handle it easily. I have to study. I'm OCD.
Yeah.
Obsessively, compulsively preparer. That's why I keep getting on you for.
I understand.
I understand.
Because you're a control freak and you're afraid of chaos.
Yes. Oh, not afraid of chaos. I despise chaos. So.
It's a tough road to chaos is all around.
Yes, but I don't have to be part of it.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
I try to straighten everything out.
Good.
In fact, I could really straighten out your desk.
Oh, you don't have to.
And no, it's a mess.
I know. These are very select items. I just cleaned it before you came. They're all put in a place where it is organized in my own way. And they're random. They were from the old garage, which was much more cluttered, and I just picked some random stuff to remind me of where I started.
Why do you need a hammer?
I don't need it.
Hammer.
It was just that was a. It was from an event in my past. We found it, and it was a funny moment.
It was an event.
Yeah, it was like I don't remember what exactly the hammer, but I remember the
The knife was left in an apartment that I once lived in, and it's sitting on an unpressed record. Oh. And these things, like, these are from
But it's
Hawaii.
A scary old
I thought about that
knife.
When I cleaned it. I did think about that.
I mean, it's a, you know, what do you call it, the kind what, that the you
switch
pull?
Switchblade? It's not a switchblade, no.
No.
But I find that if you have a few things on the desk, sometimes people pick things up and, you know, they
need to.
Well,
only if they're bored.
Well, I don't know if they're bored, but I think that some people are fidgety.
Oh, geez, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
people who have, do you know Spilkus?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do know some Spilkus. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think I misused Spilkus recently.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I misused it. Spilkus is.
Ants in your pants.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little. What did you say?
Well, I thought it meant, I was looking for the Yiddish word that meant pride.
Pride?
Yeah. But I don't think I found it. It's not Spilkus. It was another word that I didn't have in my Yiddish, you know, I didn't have it.
Glossary.
Yes, that's it. So the book's a big deal for you. It's
for
a long
me?
Time coming. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take you to write it?
Ridiculous. Practically a decade. My husband
Thank God you had the time.
My husband kept saying to me,
yeah.
Have you gotten your parents out of China yet? Because, you know, I couldn't get it going.
Yeah.
And finally I decided I needed a deadline.
Yeah. And you got one?
Yeah.
Well, I will say this. I will say that the parts I read were very good and very informative, and they let me get to know you a little better. The parts I didn't read are for the public and for me to finish. But I do feel like I still, in light of our conversation, handled it the best way I can. I don't think I would have got the German character. I don't think I would have got the English character. Yeah. I don't think we would have been on the train with Dan Rather. I think there's a lot of things that wouldn't have happened had I done it differently.
But I chose to give it to you.
I know that. But but if I just led you down the line with a series of questions from the book, chapter to chapter, then, yeah. I mean, are you going to do the British character tonight at the event?
Perhaps.
No, you're not. You're not going to do
it. Yes, I am. What makes you think I'm not?
I have a feeling, Connie.
You do?
Yeah, I have a feeling that you're going to be with a moderator, you're going to be fed up, and you're just going to take over the conversation.
You know, why don't you come and see?
All right. Well, it was good talking to you, Connie.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
Would you...
What? Walk your bag out?
No. I carry my own bags, and I have two under my eyes, and I keep them with me, and I don't even check them.
Well, what were you going to ask me?
Huh? I don't remember now.
Okay. Well, have fun
okay.
on your book tour.
Thank you.
Connie Chung's new book, Connie, A Memoir, is out now. Hang out for a minute. Full Marin listeners. You know who you are. Right now, you can hear something that was a watershed moment in the history of this show and my career. We posted my 2011 keynote address at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival, and believe me, that was something I never expected to do, and it was more emotional than funny.
So I was broke, I was defeated, I was careerless, and I started doing this podcast in that very garage where I was planning my own demise. And, you know, I'm not going to try not to get choked up with this because this thing has been an emotional thing for me. Yeah, I started talking about myself on the mic with no one telling me what I could do or what I could say. I started reaching out to comics immediately. You know, I needed help. You know, I needed, personal help, professional help. I needed to talk to people. So I reached out to my peers. And I talked to them, you know, and I started feeling better about life, you know, comedy, creativity, community. I mean, I was lost. You know, and then I started to understand who I was by talking to other comics and then sharing it with everybody else. And I started to laugh at things again. I was excited to be alive. Oh, holy fuck. Doing the podcast and listening to comics literally saved my life. And I realized that is what comedy can do for people. And you know what the industry had to do with that? Nothing! Nothing!
To get bonus episodes twice a week, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's just some straight up guitar through my, I think I have found the sound. Or at least the amp and guitars that I feel like I've been searching my whole life for. No looper today. Monkey and La Fonda, Cat Angels everywhere.